The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome to the Christian Outlook, the weekly radio program that sorts through the issues in our fast-changing world in a way that honors your Christian faith. Brought to you in partnership with our sponsor, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. This week, China's aspirations for global hegemony have become overwhelmingly clear.
He's building up his military as fast as he can.
80 years after the attack on Pearl Harbor, we'll look back at how the nation woke up.
The Japanese Admiral Tojo said, "I worry that we have awakened a dragon."
And we'll look at where we are today.
I'm not ready to write America off yet.
We'll also look at the toll of 2 years of pandemic. The
reporters didn't just, you know, not question what was going on, but really abetted what was going on.
And the biological male smashing records in swimming, competing as a woman.
The school is perfectly fine with it. The NCAA is fine with it.
We have all this and more. I'm your host, Don Crow, coming to you from my home station of WAVA in Washington, D.C. Available at WAVA.com and also through the TuneIn radio app. Thanks for joining us today. We'll begin with China. They are set to host the Winter Olympic Games in February in Beijing. They are also culpable for the pandemic that continues to haunt our nation and the entire planet. President Biden has spoken of the competition between our two nations. What has become increasingly clear is that they are moving forward boldly and aggressively on their plans to lead on the world stage. The question is, has the American nation and our current leadership woken up? I turn to a regular guest on my program, Cliff May of the Foundation for Defense of Democracies. Elaborate first, if you would, on the global supremacy agenda of one Xi Jinping, the General Secretary of the Communist Party. You say it's an agenda that he's left no doubt about for anybody who's watching. Tell us more of what confirms that.
Well, for one thing, he's building up his military as fast as he can. You may have seen recently one of the things he's done is to exceed America's ability by developing hypersonic missiles. These hypersonic missiles could hit us with nuclear weapons, and we have no missile defense for them, and we don't have hypersonic missiles of our own. Not that we couldn't develop them. We just haven't tried very hard to do so. As he's doing that, he has been taking not just islands, but reefs in the South China Sea and developing them into military installations because he wants to claim that international waterways that are very important in national commerce are really lakes and rivers that belong to China, and you will have to pay your toll as you go through. It belongs to China. He is threatening Taiwan. He has taken away the freedom from people of Hong Kong, which he was obligated under a treaty. That's the most fundamental international law is a treaty. He had said when the British gave up Hong Kong, its colony, he had guaranteed that it would be. They have their own system and have their freedoms. He's taken all that away very suddenly. Of course, you think of all the other things that he has done. He's persecuting ethnic and religious minorities, the Uyghurs, a Muslim and Turkic minority. They're accused with validity. China is accused with validity of genocide there. They have taken over Tibet and they're colonizing it. They've released a deadly virus from Wuhan. They're debt-trapping poor nations and establishing in those poor nations military installations and ports, the most recent one on the west coast of Africa facing the U.S. It's a very strategic thing. And I could go on, but the basis of it is this. If we agree that the Cold War was a struggle for global supremacy between two superpowers, it is now absolutely clear that Xi Jinping wants global supremacy for the People's Republic of China ruled by the Chinese Communist Party. And the tougher question is, while he's fighting this Cold War against us, are we fighting a Cold War against him, or are we still kind of thinking, huh, I don't know what we want to do about this? And I'd kind of say that's where certainly the Biden administration is.
Well, I want to come back to that latter point, but you remind me a few years ago in some of my work in Tanzania, I remember being told the story of how China, of course, is spreading its money all over the world, especially all over the continent of Africa. And they did offer to build a strategic rail connection. I think it was between Dar es Salaam and Morogoro, where I often go. And the Chinese wanted to build that, but the prime minister or the president of the country wisely said, no, thanks. We don't want your money, because he knew the strings that are often attached when China can get these nations indebted. Am I right?
You're exactly right. It's going on all over the world as part of something called the Belt and Road Initiative. They offer to build a port, offer to build a rail line, offer to build a stadium. They bring in Chinese workers to do it, so it doesn't produce much in the way of employment or transference of skills. And then if it can't be paid back, they take it over. Now, also, very good with the case you talk about, but I think we know that there are many cases where they say to a ruler in Africa, by the way, if you agree to this, wonderfully beneficial for your nation, we're happy to help you. By the way, check your accounts in the Cayman Islands, because you're a richer man than you know. It's very easy for them to do that and get what they want, including, say, the use of a port that's theirs, because they've debt-strapped a nation for 99 years, and they use it for military purposes. The other thing they're doing assiduously in Africa is taking out the natural resources they want and need. So this is part of what they're doing, and they're doing this throughout Africa. I call it a kind of neo-colonialism, neo-imperialism. Yeah. But they're doing it in Latin America as well. They're doing it wherever they can. And what Kennedy said, and this is in 61, he said it next month, in 61, he said, he spoke of those nations who would make themselves our adversary. Well, that's certainly the People's Republic of China. And then says the following. This is important. We dare not tempt them with weakness. Wow. Well, I think that was true then. I think it's just as true now. Yeah. And I do think the current president is tempting our adversaries with weakness almost everywhere around the globe.
Well, obviously, it underscores again the desperate need for change, not only coming up in the midterms, but certainly in 24. Let's hope we can move in a different direction. But how hopeful are you that this administration is going to give any recognition or cognizance to what we've just talked about?
I think they're going to avoid it as much as they can. You've got you've got Hunter Biden involved in that. I don't think a year ago President Biden understood the threat based on the things he said that the People's Republic of China represents. There is some recognition within his administration, but we'll see. Right now, of course, you've got threats against Taiwan, I think they are very real threats. You've got Putin, of course, threatening Ukraine at the same time. I think both Putin and Xi say, we have an opportunity now because there's a very weak president. What is he going to do? Yeah. Maybe we should move ahead with our ambitions now. Will it get better or worse 3 years from now? That's the calculation they have to make, and I'm not smart enough to tell you how that comes out.
This week, we were also reminded of our nation's miscalculation of a different Asian threat. Imperial Japan and the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor on December 7th, 1941, 80 years ago from Wednesday this past week. Kevin McCullough turned to K.T. McFarland, who served as Deputy National Security Advisor under President Trump, from AM 570 The Mission in New York City.
It is an important day when you look at kind of the division of the modern world, because previous to that war, there was kind of a different world order, and coming out of it, there were forces that were aligned completely different till really the end of the Cold War.
Yeah, and what's been running through my head in the last couple of weeks is before World War II, before Pearl Harbor, the take on America, we were in a depression. We had a lot of political fighting back and forth from one party to another. And a lot of commentators, including our own commentators, were kind of writing us off. Oh, America, you're kind of finished. The Germans kind of wrote us off. The Japanese certainly wrote us off. They had the Pearl Harbor attack. And there's a moment in, apocryphal probably, but where the admiral of the Japanese fleet after Pearl Harbor, where they had a very successful attack on the American Pacific fleet, said, everyone was cheering, every Japanese was cheering, what a great success. And the Japanese admiral, Tojo, said, I worry that we have awakened a dragon and America will come back, you know, and we will be defeated by a resilient America. And then I kept thinking about Ronald Reagan in the 1970s, late 1970s. Everybody wrote America off, right? The economy didn't work. Russian economy was going to be so much better. The United States was in retreat around the world. And yet Ronald Reagan was elected in 1980. And what did he do? He restored America. And America went on to win another war, the Cold War, this time without firing a shot. And I think we're at one of those moments today. I think that we're at the point, we're just starting to turn the corner so that in 2022, we elect Republicans, and in 2024, we elect a Republican president who will be like FDR was or like Reagan was. Hmm. And I think we'll, in fact, stand up to our adversaries, rally our allies, and restore American greatness. I'm not ready to write America off yet.
KT, I so hope that you're right. I mean, with from the deepest recesses of my heart, I yearn for what you're just saying to come true. It is hard to accept when you see the kind of dominance that Putin and Ping and their allies are trying to, you know, express in kind of bellicose fashion, when you do see the very addled kind of, you know, response that we're making from the White House. And then on top of that, you just got, you know, mayors like Mayor de Blasio that's just going to, you know, make another power grab on his way out the door. It seems like a more difficult time. I'm hopeful that your reminders historically for us today are something that will play out.
You know, the thing about Americans is we're slow to anger. You know, we have such exciting lives of our own lives. We're concerned with our jobs and our families and going to soccer games. We tend not to look at all the other stuff, the political stuff that other countries and people focus on until it gets to the crisis point. I mean, you know, it's like we all went to sleep a year and a half ago with COVID. We all locked down over COVID. And it's like we've emerged. And a lot of my friends, and I know you're saying this to your friends, are saying, what the heck happened?
Yeah.
You know, how have we had socialists taking over our government? How have we had this anti-American hatred taking over our schools and our town councils? And I think that, again, Americans are slow to anger, but I do think we're starting to change.
Well, I hope that you're right. Let's kind of extend the thought here, though. China and Russia are acting badly on the big stage, and we're not confronting them right now. What's the consequence going to be?
Well, it'll be like it was before World War II, where the Nazi Germans were acting badly and the Japanese were acting badly. And I think that the Russians will press on trying to take over Ukraine for a whole lot of reasons that they think it's their right. And I think that China wants to take over Taiwan. And I think the two countries will try to do a 1-2 punch against Taiwan and against Ukraine, and probably starting next month with Russia making moves against Ukraine, and probably starting in March, China making moves against Taiwan. I think, unlike World War II, this will not necessarily be military moves, although they could. They've demonstrated they have the ability, but I think they will far more likely do economic moves or cyber attacks against those two countries.
Coming up, we'll evaluate 2 years of pandemic.
Reporters didn't just, not question what was going on, but really abetted what was going on.
Stay with us. The Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. From lockdowns and mask mandates to school closures and vaccine mandates, the government response has been successful at least at further dividing an already divided nation and undermining public trust in our public health authorities. Many, of course, are still recovering from the virus itself. But a recovery of the public trust and an easing of the polarization of the nation will be a much more formidable task. Alex Berenson is a former New York Times reporter who, in the eyes of his former colleagues, became something of a renegade in his covering all things COVID since the early days of the pandemic. He joined my colleague Eric Metaxas.
What is in the book Pandemia for folks who are utterly unaware of you and what you've been doing?
I mean, I think that's a really good way you put it. You know, you expected that the military, you know, can defend the country. Maybe they spend too much on a plane or whatever, but they can do their job. When I worked at the Times, I was there, not for a cup of coffee, for 10 years. I believed our job was to report the facts, you know. And of course, every human being has bias, and there's going to be bias in story selection and stuff. But that my job was to get to the facts of a particular story as best I could. And I do think that that's gone. And in writing Pandemia, you know, it's only been 2 years, but to see mistake after mistake that the public health authorities and governments made, and the way that the reporters didn't just, you know, not question what was going on, but really abetted what was going on. I mean, those are some of the themes in the book. I think people have sort of lived through this. We've all lived through this maelstrom in the last 2 years. But when you step back and you see how, for example, school closures. I've talked a lot about school closures, and I talk about them in the book. They were a terrible idea. Okay, and it was clear almost from the beginning that they were a terrible idea. I am on record on Twitter, before Twitter banned me, saying they're a terrible idea in April and May, not of this year, in April and May of 2020. Okay, so that happened, and we all sort of agree that school closures now took a year of schooling away from kids, did nothing for them. Zoom schooling is terrible. And yet the media basically doesn't acknowledge its own role in that, doesn't acknowledge the public health authorities gave terrible advice, doesn't really question how this happened, has just moved on to the next orders given by whether it's, you know, the Biden administration or Fauci. They are all cheerleaders. And that, to me, is one of the central lessons in the book, is that you can't trust, you know, even after a mistake has been made and it's obvious, you can't trust these people to go back and acknowledge that at all.
Okay, well, what happened? I've written a book on Germany in the 30s and trying to understand what happened there. Now, if you're a racist German hater, it's very simple. They're uniquely evil, and we don't even have to worry about that. But if you have what I call a biblical view of reality, you realize we are all messed up and we're all susceptible to certain kinds of mistakes and sins. And sometimes history has a field day with that, as we saw in Germany in the 30s. What I see happening now is at least similar. In other words, it's an unprecedented level of people covering their rear ends, looking the other way, afraid of losing cultural capital. In other words, doing whatever it takes, short of saying, Heil Hitler, which Jew do you want me to kill today? In other words, we're not there, but it's the same kind of dynamic where you need everyone to do his job, but most people are just thinking, I don't want to lose my job, I don't want to lose credibility. And so it falls to just the tiniest handful of people like you to do what was once considered basic 5 minutes ago. That's my summation of it. What do you think?
I mean, I think that's very true. Look, I think in the United States, there clearly was a recognition in the media that the pandemic was terrible for Trump, that he'd mishandled it, that his, you know, he's clearly not the most empathetic guy in the world, and that that did not serve him well in this setting. But you're right. That doesn't explain why the rest of the world did exactly the same thing, why it shut down exactly the same way. And I think there was a lot of fear very early on. There was fear based on, you know, some of the videos that came out of China, some of the data. In the data, you know, I think we now know we can't trust the data from China at all. But nonetheless, that set government policy and public health policy. And really only Sweden stood up, you know, in Europe and said, no, this shouldn't happen. We're gonna take a less restrictive approach. And in the U.S., there were a few southern states, a few red states that stood up. Their governors faced tremendous blowback. I mean, I think Ron DeSantis, you know, if I could write another book kind of just about him and like how he played this, because I think he's a genuine hero in this. Even if you think he was wrong on certain details, just having the stones to stand up to the media and what he was getting from the public health establishment, I think he's somebody who was courageous and believed he understood what was going on and was going to stand for that. But as you say, there are very, very few people in the media, in politics, or in science, unfortunately, who are willing to do that.
Leah Thomas has made national headlines this past week The University of Pennsylvania swimmer has been smashing women's records in pool. The issue is, Leah Thomas is a biological male who competed as Will Thomas for 3 years in the NCAA. More and more people are recognizing it's just not right. Here's my colleague, Bob Burney, from WRFD The Word in Columbus, Ohio.
The swimmer who is smashing records? Well, yeah, it's a male competing against other females. You heard about this? He competed as a male for 3 years against other males. Didn't set a record. In fact, really didn't do that well. Then he became transgender, and all of a sudden he is smashing female records. And it's not going over well with the female swimmers that he is beating. This swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania competed for 3 years collegiately as Will Thomas, a boy, a man. And then he transitioned. And now he calls himself Leah Thomas, a transgender swimmer at the University of Pennsylvania. And not only is he setting new records, he is shattering records. Was because he's a man competing against girls. Oh, and by the way, the school is perfectly fine with it. The NCAA is fine with it. He, who identifies as a she, says, quote, "Swimming is a huge part of my life and who I am. I've been a swimmer since I was 5 years old. The process of coming out as being trans and continuing to swim was a lot of uncertainty and unknown around an area that's usually really solid. Realizing I was trans threw that into question. Was I going to keep swimming? What did it look like?" Listen to this, he says. "Being trans has not affected my ability to do this sport, and being able to continue is very rewarding." Well, what it has done is given him an unbelievably unfair advantage over the females. Even those on the liberal left, sooner or later, have got to wake up. Where are the feminists? Where are the liberal feminists protecting women's sports? If this is allowed to continue, it will absolutely destroy women's sports. Oh, what does the progressive liberal left do to everything it touches? Destroys it.
Coming up,
we live in a world with more and more information, but less and less wisdom.
When the Christian Outlook returns in a moment. Welcome back to the Christian Outlook, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. I'm Don Crow. Wisdom. Most of us appreciate it in others when we see it. And most of us would like to be a source of it in each arena of our own lives. But both the content of our media world and the platforms of our social media delivery mechanisms mitigate against our efforts to grow in godly wisdom. Brett McCracken of the Gospel Coalition has provided some practical help for a life of wisdom in his book, The Wisdom Pyramid, Feeding Your Soul in a Post-Truth World. McCracken joined Bob Lapine on KKLA's Southern California Live program.
Most of life, we have to rely on godly wisdom to know how to navigate the choices that are in front of us. And that means that for us to have skill in living, we have to be people who cultivate a heart of wisdom. The Bible speaks to that. Get wisdom. Biblical wisdom. Here's the issue I want us to spend some time with today. Do we have a wisdom deficit in our culture today? I'm not talking about the broader culture. I'm talking about among evangelical Christians. Would we look at ourselves? Would we look at one another? Would we look at the church today and say, there is a lack of godly wisdom at work among us? To cultivate a heart of wisdom may be one of the most important skills we need to develop if we're going to walk in a manner worthy of our calling, which is what the Bible calls us to. So let's talk about the dearth of wisdom. You say there are reasons why we live in the shallows today instead of in the depths of wisdom, right?
Yeah. I mean, the first line of the book is that we live in a world with more and more information, but less and less wisdom. And I think that paradox is really what I've noticed and what I've wanted to explore because, you know, we do live in an age where we have access to information and knowledge unlike any generation in human history. Like, we have at our fingertips, in our smartphone, in our device, we have the world's most powerful library card. You know, if you think about, like, what the library card represented for people a generation ago, it was kind of this access card for a world of knowledge. But even that was limited. There was only so much knowledge in any given library that you could access. But now we have literally unlimited access at our fingertips. Any question we might have, anything we might be interested in, is just a Google search away. So you would think logic would lead you to assume that that would lead to kind of a pinnacle of wisdom, that we would be living in the golden age of wisdom. But I don't think anyone would say that that's true, right? You look around us today at the headlines and look at your Facebook feed and you just kind of shake your head at the foolishness that is abounding. So there's something about the rise in information and kind of the overabundance, the excess, I call it information gluttony, that actually works against our wisdom and makes it harder to be wise. There's kind of an inverse correlation of information and wisdom. The first half of the book, I really go into some of the specific dynamics of the information age that we're living in that are making it harder and harder to be wise, because there's always something else, right? There's always another article to read, another blog post, another podcast you have to listen to, another Substack. And because that's our orientation these days, it's ravenous consumerism, but it's kind of a mile wide and inch deep, right? We never take the time to let any of it digest.
I am aware of what this has done to my ability to focus and to sustain something and how easily distracted I am. I mean, on one hand, I can revel in my ability to multitask, but there's something about multitasking that you're never really thinking profoundly or deeply about any one thing because you're watching three or four other things at the same time.
Yeah, no. And, you know, with the reading, you mentioned like having a hard time sitting down with a book for an extended period of time. That's a common experience today. One of the books that I cite in the Wisdom Pyramid is a book called Reader Come Home by Marianne Wolfe. And she's a scholar of kind of books and reading. And there's actual like neuroscience that is showing that our brains are kind of being rewired in the digital age, in the internet age, because our dominant mode of processing information is this mile wide, inch deep, kind of bite size, a tweet here, a paragraph of an article there,
right?
Maybe a headline from CNN. Because that's the dominant way we're processing information, our brains are like actually changing and they're not able to process information in a kind of more focused, slow way. And that's why a lot of people are, you know, I'm a bookworm. I love books. I always have. But in the last couple of years, I've found it to be increasingly a struggle to like sit still for like 30 minutes or more and just like read a book without grabbing for my phone to do who knows what.
Coming up,
we're either going to be wise or we're going to be foolish. And a lot of it has to depend on the makeup of what's coming into our hearts and our minds.
We'll look at our inputs as it relates to wisdom when the Christian Outlook returns in a moment.
The Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy believes in the calling to politics and public service. As one of the few programs of its kind based at a leading Christian university, we prepare students for exciting careers in this vital arena through a curriculum that combines rigorous study of America's founding principles with the latest tools of policy analysis. The application period for fall 2022 classes has begun, so find out more at pepperdine.edu/SPP. That's pepperdine.edu/SPP.
Welcome back to The Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. Many, or perhaps most of us, want to be wise. But is that desire deep enough or sincere enough for us to change our inputs? or change the diet of what we put into our minds and souls. If we are indeed willing, I think we'll find some helpful, practical guidance from the Wisdom Pyramid. Let's return to Brett McCracken with Bob Lapine on KKLA in Los Angeles.
Let me jump to what you propose as the solution in the book and explain to everybody the Wisdom Pyramid and how it relates to what we were all taught about how we should eat when we were in elementary school.
Yeah, so basically my thesis is that we are wise by virtue of our intakes. So just like physical health depends on what comes into your body, you know, for good or for ill, you're either going to be physically healthy or physically unhealthy based on what constitutes your diet of intakes. Well, the same is true of our spiritual health and our wisdom. We're either going to be wise or we're going to be foolish, and a lot of it has to depend on the makeup of what's coming into our hearts and our minds. So I think there's a parallel, right, between physical eating and our diet and our diet of ideas, our diet of media with our spiritual health. So I'm really just taking that food pyramid concept, which hopefully everyone who's listening, you know, has a visual in their mind of what that looked like. Back in the day when we were kids, we learned the food pyramid. Essentially, it was like the food groups at the bottom were the ones you should focus on and have more kind of in your diet, and the ones at the top were the ones that were most potentially hazardous and should occupy a smaller portion of your diet. And so I just literally just take that whole concept and apply it to wisdom. And so the wisdom pyramid is just something I came up with that has kind of knowledge groups instead of food groups. And at the bottom is the Bible, which I would say is the most important food group, if you will, for our wisdom. And then at the top, which is the fats, oils, and sweets part of the food pyramid, where you're kind of supposed to use it sparingly, that's where I put the internet and social media. So I'm basically suggesting, in practice, we've kind of inverted this, and that's what's making us sick as a society. That's what's making us foolish, is we've made what should be in the dessert category, we've made it the staple of our diet. And so we need to kind of audit our intakes and rethink what's feeding our soul if we want to become wise.
We're gorging ourselves on spiritual Twinkies instead of eating anything that would have more substance to it. So between the Bible and the internet, you've got some other things that build out that pyramid. Explain what's in there.
Yeah, so the Bible is at the bottom. And my rationale with ordering the levels of the wisdom pyramid was pretty simple. I was just thinking, you know, wisdom is from God. That's kind of the simple explanation of what wisdom is, I think, is being aligned to God's reality and how he designed things and his moral kind of purposes and his design. And so it makes sense that if we want to become wise, we should feed at the sources that are closest in proximity to God. And so from the bottom of the wisdom pyramid up to the top, it kind of goes from most proximate to God in the Bible, which is his direct speech to us. It's kind of, you know, direct from the source, to Twitter at the top, which is like, you know, not even human. It's like algorithms that are giving you information. So from the next category from the bottom up is the church. And my rationale there is the whole proximity to God thing. If the Bible is our most direct access to God, his church is his presence among his people. It's his mission. It's his kind of chosen mission in the world. And it's an eternal institution. Nothing else on earth will last into eternity except the church. So it needs to occupy a big portion of our lives and our wisdom diet. So after the church, so it goes Bible, church, and then nature is my third most foundational category of wisdom. And again, this is proximate to God because it's what he made. It's his handiwork. You know, the heavens declare the glory of God, the Bible tells us. There are things we can learn about God just by observing nature, by studying it in the sciences, and just kind of being outside rather than being mediated always through a screen, which we tend to do in today's world. There's something about going outside in God's creation and just letting your senses take it in that I think it gives wisdom in almost intangible ways that we can't always put our finger on. we are creatures of a creator. And when we are outside, when we're in God's creation, we're kind of in our proper place. So after nature, I have a whole section of the Wisdom Pyramid for books. And essentially what I'm arguing is not just that books are helpful for our wisdom in what they contain in terms of the content, but also the format. To go back to what we were saying about the way we process information in very, you know, superficial, ephemeral ways. To read a book is to train, kind of retrain those muscles of critical thinking and slowing down and processing. So I really think that having books as a part of our diet is going to be helpful in just kind of becoming better thinkers and becoming better listeners. You know, the Bible says, you know, we should be quick to listen and slow to speak. And I say in the book that reading a book is literally practicing that verse. Mm-hmm. We are being quick to listen and slow to speak when we sit down with a book and give our attention to one author's perspective, you know, for a week or a month or however long it takes to read the book. And then the second to the top, and it's kind of a shame that it's that high because people are like, assume that I'm saying it's not important, but it is important, and that's beauty, kind of the arts. And this is because wisdom is, again, it's not just information, it's not just data, it's not only a cerebral thing. Wisdom involves our senses, our heart, our loves, and I think beauty works on that level, right? Beauty is what kind of tunes our heart to sing God's praise. That's why singing has always been a part of Christian worship, because there's the recognition that we become wise not only through content that is delivered to our brain, but in forms and beauty that speaks to our heart. And so I think in everyone's wisdom diet, we need to make space for the arts and for things that, you know, we pick up through our ears and our eyes. And, you know, Psalm 34:8 says, taste and see that the Lord is good.
Right.
It didn't say no cerebrally that the Lord is good. That's important, but it's interesting that it says taste and see. So I think using our senses and what the arts and beauty really engage our senses is a really important part of wisdom.
Coming up, a good rule of thumb on our media consumption.
Is this going to move me closer to God?
A few minutes more on wisdom in the final segment of the Christian Outlook. Stay with us.
This is Jerry Boyer. On the newest edition of Meeting of Minds podcast, I interviewed David Bahnsen, author of the new book, There's No Free Lunch. David here talks about how some of the greatest economists who defended freedom did not understand that it is a gift from God.
And then Hayek came around with price discovery, with the knowledge problem, with the fatal conceit, and you got this intellectual battle that is played out. And yet one thing was missing from it for people like you and me. The leading truth tellers were not Christians.
Right.
The Christian church was absent from the great economic debate of the 20th century. Mm. So I won't take away anything that in common grace, Milton Friedman, Friedrich Hayek, Ludwig von Mises contributed to 20th century dialogue.
To hear the entire in-depth interview with Bahnsen about his fascinating book, go to meetingofmindspodcast.com. That's meetingofmindspodcast.com.
Welcome back to the Christian Outlook. I'm Don Crow. I hope you found this challenge from Brett McCracken on wisdom helpful. Whether or not a pursuit of godly wisdom is fashionable or popular, there is no question that a pursuit of it and walking in it will provide a healthy reward. As we pursue wisdom, I hope we'll be willing to place our media consumption choices under greater scrutiny. Let's return for a few more minutes of Brett McCracken with Bob Lapine on KKLA in Los Angeles.
It's hard for us to be making wise media choices if we're not pursuing wisdom as a general principle of life in the first place, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And one of the things that I've noticed when it comes to Christians wisely consuming pop culture, engaging pop culture, is the ones who do it well and who are able to kind of exercise discernment are the ones who have that foundation of the wisdom pyramid kind of in a good place. Like, they're biblically literate. They love the Bible. They love God's word. They love the church. That's what's feeding their soul the most. And what happens when that's the bottom of your wisdom diet is that you're in a better place, you're in a better position to kind of watch a variety of things or read a variety of books, you know, even by atheist writers, and you'll be in a better position to critically evaluate, you know, in any given book or any given movie that I consume. Because I know the Bible decently well, because I have a good grasp of what kind of God's design is, I'm able to, like, say, okay, this aspect of this movie is good and true, and it actually, you know, reinforces what the Bible says, and it doesn't contradict it. So let's celebrate that. But this aspect of this movie goes against the truth as God reveals it to us in Scripture, and so that aspect we have to reject. One kind of rule of thumb that I utilize in my own approach to pop culture is just the simple question, is this going to move me closer to God? You know, ultimately, that's a good question to ask. If you're going to spend a couple hours of your life with some piece of culture, you know, do you want to, like, waste a couple hours that's going to like, move you in the opposite direction of God, or just kind of be a lifeless, inert, disposable experience? Or is there something about it that might illuminate God's world in such a way that kind of stirs your heart to praise him and to recognize some true aspect of the world he made? And I think at its best, that's what art can do. That's what it does for me. You know, some of the most transcendent experiences I've had with the art is that moment where something clicks and it's like an epiphany, and it's like something that I knew was true of God is expressed in a beautiful way through art. And so that moves me closer. That's a part of my spiritual formation. And so I think asking that question, if you're going to engage something in pop culture, is it moving you forward in your walk with God? Because ultimately that's what wisdom is about. It's aligning your life with God and his purposes and his design. And art and pop culture can do that, but it can also work in the opposite direction if we're not careful.
That wraps up this edition of the Christian Outlook. Thanks for joining us today. You can catch the complete conversation with Brett McCracken at ChristianOutlook.com. And while you're there, remember to subscribe to our podcast. Our program has been brought to you in part through our partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Don Crow. Join us again next time for the Christian Outlook.
Three-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.